race is on. And over the past week, we've seen Charles Leclerc driving the 2020 Ferrari around Maranello and Racing Point and Renault back in action as this unusual attempt at a second pre-season hots up. But what should we expect from Ferrari once the season starts? And how worried should we be that another F1 team in McLaren potentially needs to sell a stake amid the ongoing financial pressures? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to get excited about the upcoming new season today are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. Mark, how are you feeling about the fact that you're now less than 2 weeks away from the season? Presumably you're riding your bike around at double speed, given the rising excitement.
Yeah, it's getting ever more excited as it gets closer and closer. It actually seems impossible that it can be just a couple of weeks from now, because we've been without it. It feels like years. But yeah, riding a bike even faster. Although I got caught out in a thunderstorm the other day on that. But it's tangible now, isn't it? It's coming, which is great.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? It'll go from a point where we thought the season would never get underway in this period of lockdown and nothing happening would never end, and then in a couple of months' time we're going to be 10 odd races down as we rattle through the season. So it's going to be quite the dramatic change. Scott, big weekend for you in Sweden.
Yeah, it is. It's midsummer, which is a big celebration over here. So much like they do at Christmas, the Swedes do it slightly weirdly. They have a day dedicated to something, but they do all the celebration of it on the day before, so Midsummer's Eve. Same as Christmas Eve. Christmas Day is not... They don't really care about that over here. Christmas Eve is the big one.
Well, I saw the film Midsummer last year, I think, so I'm slightly suspicious about whether you'll last the distance.
Yeah, don't worry. I'm not in some... I'm in my flat in Stockholm rather than out in the countryside or on an island. So don't worry. It's all going to be safe. We can expect what we would call over here a glad midsummer.
Excellent. I'll keep an eye for in the background any signs of folk horror tropes creeping into you're on a video. You're on a video call. Yes, in the video I can see of you.
You don't need to worry about that because, as you can see, it's just me and my biggest fan.
An excellent visual joke that works brilliantly. Scott is currently grinning like he's made the best joke in history and pointing to a big freestanding fan, which I should say isn't pointing at you. So
No. Well, my fans tend not to. They tend to shun me.
Over your other shoulder, I can see your sim racing rig.
Yeah, exactly. The visual stick on this podcast is going really well. Yeah, this is the quality of equipment that considerably outdoes the quality of the person using it.
Yeah, we won't talk about you're having an amazing run of races where you're showing very good pace and potential, but don't quite string it together.
Yeah, as my mum said when she asked me how it's going, and I said, quite quick, but I keep getting taken out or making a mistake. And she said, exactly like your karting career then.
Yeah, that's fair. Or spinning coming out the pit lane.
Yeah, exactly. But that slicks on a wet track. That's difficult. Ask Jenson Button about Australia, what, 2010 was it, or 2011?
Yeah, 10.
He knows how hard it is.
Yeah, but he did go on to win that race. It was a good trick, actually, because by going off on his outlap on slicks, it made people think he'd gone too early and helped him win.
Exactly. And I tricked everybody into thinking I knew what I was doing, and then I banked a 19th place finish. So
yeah, so, well, it can only go better next time, I hope. But anyway, well, let's get on with actually talking about Formula One and start off with you, Mark. There's been mixed messages about the progress Ferrari has or has not made with its car ahead of the Austrian Grand Prix. You're obviously very well connected in Italy. So what's your understanding of the situation?
Ferrari's public message is very much in expectation management mode. Mattia Binotto explicitly saying, expect us to be no better than the third fastest car behind Mercedes and Red Bull. And just like all the other teams, they will have a package of upgrades compared to Barcelona testing. Some of which we would have seen on the car at Melbourne, some in the few weeks of development time outside a factory shutdown since then. But it's clear they aren't expecting those changes to have leapfrogged the car up to the front since those 2 weeks of testing, when it showed nothing that would have had Mercedes concerned. It had lost the straight line advantage of last year's car, and although it addressed some of that car's weaknesses in the slow corners with a better balance and more downforce generally, it wasn't by enough. This car, the SF1000, is essentially just an update of that fast but flawed car of last year, which had great power but a general shortfall of front downforce, especially in the low-speed range. So really, it would appear that the inboard-loaded front wing concept had simply run out of development potential and wasn't the ultimate solution to the regs introduced last year. But rather than make a whole scale concept change for what was going to be just 1 year when you had the old new aero formula coming, Ferrari decided a better use of its resources would be just to squeeze what it could from the existing concept. And so they'd almost written off this year, knowing it was with a compromised car. But then, of course, the new aero was delayed for a year, which was very bad news for Ferrari. Couple this with the tech directives issued late last year and tidied up a few weeks ago regarding fuel flow and how they seemed in testing to impact it upon the Ferrari horsepower advantage. It's not painting a great picture. In testing, the car looked to be not as bad as the headline numbers. It probably was vying with the Red Bull as the second fastest car, but some way off Mercedes. But I think the Red Bull is probably, its aero pack concept has probably got a greater development potential on it, and we're expecting a lot of development from Honda as well. So, yeah, I can absolutely believe that Binotto's statement is just a statement of a fact and not some sort of trick of underplaying their true performance. I don't buy that. That theory's around in places, but I don't buy that at all. The Italian media was getting very excited last week about a supposed engine upgrade for Austria, and a new gearbox casing is the original one, which has been slimmed down on this design compared to last year's, was flexing. Ferrari insists this is absolutely not the case, and neither of those features will be on the car in Austria. So I think we just see the usual generic developments from front wings and barge boards and flick-ups and louvers and things like that. I don't think we're going to see anything radically new on the car. I think that's where we're at with Ferrari.
I think it's it was borne out by their stance on the reverse grid experiments as well. I sort of have this sort of feeling that while everybody is, it's easy to sort of jump on Mercedes and accuse them of self-interest for blocking reverse grids, I think it says a lot about what sort of Ferrari were sort of expecting to be the case for them this season, and likewise Red Bull, that they were quite keen for reverse grids. Ultimately, if you think you're going to go in as the fastest car, you probably want to maintain the status quo, don't you? So I think every indication from Ferrari has been that they will be slightly behind the curve, and as Mark said, I don't think it's a bluff. I think it's they're obviously not going to be miles off, but I think they're bracing themselves, aren't they, for a tricky season, maybe a tricky couple of seasons.
It'll be interesting to see how aggressively they can upgrade that car, because as Mark's pointed out, they've got to carry it through next season as well. So I guess this rod of races, whether they can make enough changes and find enough understanding to actually make a step change in the performance that could throw them towards the front. It's going to be tough going. As a side note on the thing about engines, Günther Steiner was asked about this late last week in a press conference, and he confirmed that the engine spec would be exactly the same for them, which doesn't necessarily mean it's the same for Ferrari automatically. But usually we see the customer Ferrari teams getting the upgrade at the same time, or in fact even a race earlier. We've seen in the past. Obviously that wouldn't work in this case, because you can't kind of stagger it for the first race. But yeah, Ferrari in a very strange position. I'd certainly agree that testing, they weren't quite as bad as they looked from the headline times. I was a bit surprised people were predicting that they'd be miles behind Racing Point or sort of buried in the midfield based on the early running. But yeah, very tricky position. It's funny, Ferrari, they've never quite 100% in recent times convinced that they're completely on top of things aero-wise. They've had success in recent years, often with cars that were, shall we say, slightly overpowered in certain areas, whether it was literally in terms of power, as it was last year, or in other aspects. Just never quite had that all-round average car, the thing that James Allison's always talking about, that you design the best overall set of characteristics for the average of the circuits that you're going to this year. And that aero slight weakness that Ferrari's had for years has been a long-term problem. What do you think, Mark? Do you think this is just another manifestation of Ferrari just being that quarter step behind aerodynamically in terms of not just quite able to do what a Mercedes or a Red Bull can do?
I think it's not specifically aerodynamic. I think, say, the 2017 car and, to an extent, the 2018 car, they were very, very advanced aerodynamically, probably more advanced than the Mercedes, actually. But it's getting that rounded package, as you say. And I think that's just you're measuring it against arguably the greatest Formula One team there has ever been, and they're coming up a little bit short against them. And I think it's just a measure of their overall the roundness of their ability. And if they attack one problem, it seems to pull them down somewhere else. And operationally, I would say is where they're being the weakest. That's been their consistent weakness. Even when the cars have been super fast, they've not always been the best team on a race weekend in terms of the operation. So yeah, I agree. They're frustratingly almost there so often, but never quite put all the bits together. And you know, when you're up against a team the caliber of Mercedes, you're going to get found out.
Yeah, and that's been the case in recent years. And obviously, expectations at Ferrari are sky high, aren't they? Winning races in a season isn't enough. They need to be winning the championship, and that hasn't happened for a long time now. You've got to go all the way back to 2008 for the last time they won a constructors' championship. So yeah, hard times for them. And of course, we have seen Charles Leclerc out on a brief demo run in the 2020 car, driving around the streets of Maranello. That was last Thursday. They were doing that. So obviously, Ferrari getting themselves fired back up. Although I don't think that's going to be a huge benefit for them, is it, Scott?
No, it's not going to be something that they can get. Any kind of insight into how the car works. But it's a symbolic run. The fact that they're back, they're ready to go. There was a bit of confusion over whether or not that would immediately precede a test at Fiorano in a 2018 car, which has been widely expected. But it seems that Ferrari simply made use of one of their demonstration events that they're allowed to do. We hear teams talk about filming days quite a lot, where you've got 100 kilometres of running on Pirelli demo tyres. But there is also the lesser used demonstration event provision within the regulations, which is not on an F1 circuit and 15 kilometres in length, which is more than enough, I think, for Leclerc to get rowdy early in the morning in Maranello and wake up a few people. He put a cheeky message on Instagram, apologising to residents if he woke them up, saying that he's sorry, but he needed to get to work. So yeah, nothing from a competitive point of view. But if you want to try and spin something nice out of it, it's just a little bit of an indication of sort of what Ferrari is like as a team now. I think especially under Binotto, because I don't know whether or not I don't know how much this has been done in the interim years, but I saw an image on. Twitter where you had, I think was it Enzo driving a car out of the gates at Maranello, what would have been, must have been more than 70 years ago now. And then side by side of it was Charles bringing the 2020 car out of the gates. And Ferrari said he's the first sort of modern era driver to have driven a car on the streets of Maranello. So it's just quite cool. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't really mean that they're going to be fighting for titles or anything like that, but I do quite like this sort of new era Ferrari, shall we say, under Mattia Binotto.
Yeah, it's a little bit more fun. And just in fact, to clear up the testing regulations, because people keep asking questions about this, there's multiple different forms of testing. You can have testing of current cars, which is exactly what it sounds like, testing 2020 cars, that's basically banned. You've got testing of previous cars, which is 2016 to 2018 spec cars, which have to be in period specification, which you can do, which is what we've seen Renault do, Mercedes. There's testing of historic cars, which is for even older ones, which isn't normally that relevant to the to the current teams. And you've got promotional days, which is what's normally called a filming day, which is the 100-kilometer one, then demo event. So there's kind of five tiers of types of testing in the ever simple F1 regulations.
What about testing your eyesight? What about driving to test your eyesight, like Dominic Cummings did? Because I know Charles got wears glasses sometimes when he's doing sim racing. Maybe you could justify driving around the streets of Maranello because he was testing his eyesight in preparation for the season.
Maybe that was it. Maybe it wasn't a demonstration event at all. Maybe the argument will be I didn't break the rules. I was simply going out for a little drive in my Formula One car for an eyesight test. So, but yeah, maybe he's. Maybe that's it entirely. It would also explain why Ferrari was slightly cagey and had a little bit of mystery around it as well. They weren't entirely sure how to address it. It was a proper homage.
It certainly shows that Charles Leclerc knows he can now safely do longer distances in the car. So that's positive. Although, of course, we are here mixing sport and politics, which, as various shouty people on social media say, never, ever mix. There's never any intersection there. But anyway, before we wind people up too much, we can get on to some of the other runnings, Scott. We've seen Lance Stroll in action in the 2020 Racing Point. So that's a promotional day at Silverstone. Renault's did 2 days of testing at the Red Bull Ring with the 2018 car. So that's testing a previous car, as it's called in the regulation. So how valuable do you think these sorts of runs are?
I think we won't know for certain until we see how the teams who haven't had them fare in Austria. I think it's less about finding a way, like within the rules or the protocols, to sort of do something better. And I think it might be more people tripping up and not being able to do everything. So I think there's a finite limit to which you can operate, obviously. And then I think it will just be the teams that haven't done this running, this live work in a pit lane or in a garage, they won't necessarily get up to that level. I spoke to Andy Green, the Racing Point technical director, about this, and he said he's not convinced that there's a big advantage, so to speak, about doing it. It's more just they've had the opportunity in a live environment to go, right, this is okay, we hadn't thought about this is harder than we expected, and now they will refine their processes between now and Austria to make sure that everything's up to scratch, shall we say. And I think, like Mercedes had said before they went to their Silverstone test, that they'd sort of identified where they thought the pinch points would be, and then it's just a good opportunity to put it into practice, because you can do a lot of this work at the factory. You can simulate a lot of the environments, but there is a difference to sort of working within the confines of the garage, and then actually what it's like when a car comes into the box and you need to pull it back in, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's quite a few lessons to be learned there. I think one of the interesting things was Andy Green sort of talking about how much of a challenge certain elements will be. And the biggest thing within that will be certain elements on the car that need changing might now take twice as long. He said, for example, an engine change, you definitely don't want to be doing that in a hurry over a Grand Prix weekend. And he also pointed out that the drivers will have it, it will be made very clear to the drivers how important it is not to come back with damage, basically. So you're never encouraged to crash. It's not something the teams ever want you to do, but there's sort of a bit of an unspoken, it doesn't really matter if you crash, because obviously we'll just replace it. Whereas now it's very much we need to be careful, because not only is it going to be longer to make changes on the car, but we're going to be away for 3 weeks at a time, and we're going to do 6 races in 7 weeks and 8 races in 10 weeks or whatever it turns out to be. And churning out parts, making sure you've got enough spares, is going to be difficult as well. And that's the worst case scenario for a team to be in. Not much time to make the changes if something does break, and not many spare parts to have on the shelf if you start going through them. So it's going to be quite difficult. And I think any team that's been able to do this running, so that so far, Mercedes at Silverstone over 2 days, Racing Point at Silverstone over 1 day, Renault at the Red Bull Ring over 2 days with a 2018 car. AlphaTauri want to do a filming day at Imola. Red Bull, I'm pretty sure, are going to do something. They're going to have something quite useful, I think, from that.
I think also, you know, we talk about with drivers how they perform at its best when it's very much in the subconscious processing, but the same goes for everyone, and that's why I think these sort of simulated garages with all the getting used to the distancing and all the little measures, just having a little bit of a run at that will help team personnel just be a little bit more familiar and not having to think about whether they're doing things in the right way. And that does impact on performance for everyone. So if you do have to do something big like an engine change or just even just day-to-day tasks, it'll just be that just tiny bit more natural, that little bit quicker for them, which I think is the real value for that. So it's just a small thing that will make your team be almost less distracted, shall we say, because obviously Formula One teams work really well and smoothly because they practice stuff, they're really used to it, they're extremely accomplished people who've worked very hard to be very, very good at what they do. So I am quite interested. Mark, what do you think? Do you think we'll see some signs of shakiness and rustiness, whether it's for teams, drivers, or anyone when we get to the first Austria weekend, just because of the weird preparation for this whole season and the hiatus. The circumstances are unique.
Yeah, there's bound to be. There's got to be. How significant they turn out to be, we'll see. But one thing that does strike me is that Austria has some very aggressive curbs if you get offline. And I'm thinking around the exit of the old Texaco chicane and into the entry into the exit of the Rind, what used to be the Rind curve, the penultimate corner, which have caused all sorts of problems for teams in the past. And if we're looking at, really needing to conserve front wings and body parts and things like that, it's going to be extra tough having our first two races at that particular track. Yeah, we could see all sorts of dramas there, I think, and especially in the second week.
Yeah, interestingly, Günther Steiner, again, the Haas team principal, mentioned that there was some potential talk of initiatives to try and make the tracks less aggressive in the runoff and that kind of thing, but not really sure what's coming of that. I'd be surprised if big changes come, because those sausage curbs, for example, at Red Bull Ring are there for a reason. And actually, I quite like them, because we all talk about how we don't like it when drivers can abuse runoff and get away with mistakes. So yeah, you pay the price. Okay, it's maybe a bit extreme in terms of the amount of front wing assemblies that get beaten up in Austria. And I dread to think how many teams are having to take with them to cover two whole weekends at that circuit. But I quite like it, because it's just a circuit. I actually think the Red Bull Ring's a great place to start, because I think it's a really underrated circuit. Yeah, we know it produces exciting races, and we've had some great storylines there in recent years. But also, I think it's a really good driver's circuit, because it's challenging, it generates mistakes, it's short, sharp, and has a bit of everything.
I really like it. And on the subject of the curbs, it reminds me of the 2017 Austrian Grand Prix was the second Formula One race that I worked. And I remember the curbs were being a big talking point, the runoff and just sort of the damage that you'd get from it, and being like, oh, this is interesting, everyone's talking about this, and sort of excitedly being like, oh, this is a big concern, I think we should watch out for it this weekend, blah blah blah. Then going back there a year later, when I was in my first full season of covering Formula One, and it's almost an exact conversation again in 2018, and sort of thinking, okay, well, sort of heard this last year, but you know, I think someone has suggested that like the profiling had changed, or that was more of them, or it was necessarily the sausage curb. It's the bit that we've got not properly on the outside at the final couple of corners. So that needs to be changed. And then went back there last year, and it was exactly the same conversation again. It's like F1 drivers just don't change, do they? They will moan about something and say we need some kind of deterrent, and then they have it, and then they just get angry about it for no reason.
I quite like it as well, because you may have well watched here as well, Mark, but if you go up to turn one, for example, at the exit of that corner, you see drivers leaning on the kind of closest edge of the sausage curb. And then there's just that thing where if you go that little bit too far, you kind of drop over the edge of it, and you see them scuffing the underfloor of the car. And just, I quite like that, because you've got something where they're trying to use sort of half of a sausage curb, but just that punishment for being like a couple of millimetres too far. That's what we want from circuits, isn't it? Whereby if you just overstep that small amount, you do pay, whether it's by losing a little bit of time, a little bit of compromised exit speed, or even beating up the floor or damaging your front wing.
Yeah, it makes it more demanding. You just, you know, there's a little bit of jeopardy there. There's an advantage to be had if you can use up the last little bit of it. And it's there tempting you to take it. But there's some jeopardy there if you overstep it. So yeah, it's exactly how it should be, and you know, we'll separate out the great from the good, and that's exactly what you want from a track.
Yep, that's what it's all about. Well, looking again at off-track matters, Mark, there's been a lot of talk about McLaren's financial situation recently. There's 1,200 job cuts to come across the whole McLaren group, that is, and now there's talk about them potentially needing to sell a minority stake in the team to get a bit of a cash injection. How worried do you think we should be about the situation of McLaren?
I think we should be worried generally about the McLaren group. The team itself, I would argue, less so. But it's so, to give some background, it's an incredibly tough time for the automotive industry, and it especially isn't the time when wealthy customers go out shopping for supercars. So the McLaren factory are, you know, has been on shutdown for a few months now. McLaren Group as a whole has been taking a massive financial hit, hence the redundancies. Mumtalakat, which is the sovereign wealth fund of Bahrain, has got 59% shareholding in the group, of which the F1 team is part, and the F1 team represents about 20% of the group's turnover. And Mumtalakat put in around £300 million to the group in March, but has been reluctant to invest further. It's not a great time for the oil-based economy in the Middle East either. That still left McLaren needing additional investment just to retain its liquidity, the group I'm talking about. And that's very much an ongoing project. And part of the solution has been to issue McLaren bonds, which are interest-paying loans, essentially. But the terms of these has upset some of the existing bondholders, because bonds were also issued in 2017 in order to buy out Ron Dennis. So that row is ongoing, and it's putting pressure on all parts of the group, including the F1 team, to raise finance from somewhere else. So McLaren is looking, as you say, at selling a minority interest stake in the team. So I think the team itself is in a good place. Its prospects are good, especially now with the cost caps in place. Its trajectory of improvement is very clear. It's too good a team to just disappear. It has too much value in it. So whether it is able to remain within the McLaren group isn't really within its control. It's within the bigger finances of the group itself. Or it's quite feasible that any potential shareholder doesn't want to be a minority share. He wants to be majority shareholder, and in which case the group would then have a difficult decision to make. Do they take that, whatever that money might be on offer, to pump into the rest of the group? Or do they convince the Mumtalakat to put their hands even deeper in their pockets to retain the team within the group? So I don't think we should be worried of immediate concern in terms of the team, but it's a very tricky situation for the group.
It does show why, although diversifying and being part of a wider group can be a very positive thing, it can also be difficult in times of trouble, can't it? Because you're only as strong as your weakest link. And as you say, the automotive industry has taken an absolute beating in the past few months, because obviously people haven't been buying cars, particularly not buying pricey cars, as obviously McLaren's at the high end of it. So, yeah, an interesting situation. Obviously, there's quite a few opportunities at the moment to get a stake or get ownership of a Formula One team. We know Williams is going through its strategic review. One of the possibilities there is a sale of the whole team. We know McLaren is looking, and that there's other teams that could potentially be available. So it becomes a bit of a buyer's market for if you want to get involved with buying a chunk of an F1 team. And that means if you're trying to sell Williams, you know, if they're looking for a couple of hundred million, say, it becomes difficult to justify that valuation given the profitability or not thereof of what you're buying when there's other opportunities around. So it could become a bit of a battle to get some investment in. And of course, yeah, of course, McLaren wants to sell a minority stake because it doesn't want to lose control, does it? But people buying like to get control sometimes. So yeah, interesting times.
It is that slightly curious, I guess, sort of limbo that Formula One's in at the moment, because we've got a bit of stability in terms of spending at the moment with various cost saving measures that have been put in, delaying technical rules, etc. And we've got on the horizon a change in the fundamentals of Formula One that will bring spending under control more sort of on a bigger scale, and it will cut expenditure, and it should boost teams' income because you'll have a cost cap in place. There'll be sort of pseudo standardization of parts through open source components, and greater standardization of other parts. And then there's going to be a redistribution of the way, an adjustment of the way F1 distributes its prize money. So it should become not lucrative, but it should become much more sustainable. So you've got this bigger picture on that is going to get much better for Formula One over the next few years, but the teams that are not benefiting from that at the moment, the teams that are struggling, need to sort of get through this period to get to that sort of utopia. So you're asking all of these investors or shareholders that are and these companies that are losing money by being in Formula One, you're asking them to carry on losing money effectively for another year, 2 years, maybe 3 years, because on the promise that it should be better at the end. So I think it's quite tricky, because if you've got someone out there that's willing to invest, whether that's in McLaren as with a minority stake or buying the team completely or whatever you went for, and likewise Williams, the prospects for that team could actually be really good. As you said, a buyer's market. You could, if you turn around and said, actually, do you know what? I don't mind this investment of X hundred million pounds, dollars, euros, whatever, because I can afford that, and bigger picture, it's going to be really nice. But it's much harder to justify it if you've been losing that loads of money for the last few years to keep putting your hand in your pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole situation, ultimately, it's great Formula One has reacted to this, but frankly, F1 could have put itself in a better financial footing, F1 as a whole, far earlier, and then been in a better position to weather this. You can say, yeah, nobody foresaw the COVID-19 pandemic striking, obviously not the specific thing, but there's often these events, these times of financial hardship. They come along periodically for myriad reasons. And while some people will suffer financially through no fault of their own, and because the changing circumstances mean you can't really plan for it, Formula One as a whole was making enough money for things to be in a better position. It's in times like this when the cracks that are there start to show more. So it's just a little bit of a shame that this wasn't responded to in before the fact, shall we say, because there was always going to be something like this going on. But let's hope for McLaren's sake that they do that the race team isn't too badly affected by this, because they've done great things to get that team back on an upward trajectory. They've got some very good people there, some very good long-term strategic plans as well that can credibly be said to make that team potentially a front runner again down the line. So yeah, we can but hope that they do well, and that a team like Williams finds a buyer, because we need teams on the grid, and this is why it was necessary for the biggest teams to also partly be responsible for ensuring that all the teams in F1 were in a healthy position. So difficult time. So good luck to all on that. Scott, let's move on to upgrades. Gunter Steiner at Haas said they won't be throwing any upgrades at the team until they know what the budget situation is, given the uncertainty over the number of races. That could be a while, given the vague calendar we've got for the second part of the season. Obviously, it makes no sense for them to spend money they aren't certain they're going to have. And he said that it would be stupid to spend that money and then risk not having the running budget for the later races. So no upgrades. And they've also dialed back the design work and the aero testing work to a minimal level. So, yeah, they've kind of turned off those development taps. So that shows that the COVID-19 pandemic impact, which of course is ongoing, will be felt for a good while yet, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think the teams that can afford to sort of push through certain development absolutely will. I know Mercedes is definitely planning to do what it can in terms of development, but a team like Haas, and you'd imagine that someone like Williams must be in that boat as well. We know that Williams have said that they've got the budget to complete the season. I think that to me was a bit like the equivalent of a football like board or chairman giving a manager a vote of confidence, like this thing that no one's really questioning suddenly has this very positive need to public need to positively back it. It shouldn't really be an achievement for a team to have the budget to complete the season. So if Williams isn't running a car on track before Austria as well, because it doesn't have the budget to do so. So I can't imagine Williams is going to be churning through upgrades, and whether or not, I guess it depends how advanced the car was going to Australia, how big a gain they thought those early season upgrades would actually be. For a team like Haas, I guess you could argue that they were so lost last season and struggled so much last year that they basically just want to be, they think that there is still a lot to gain just by actually making sure that the 2020 car works and making the most out of it, because they quite easily tied themselves up in knots last year, and it wasn't the first time either. So, but all the while you have this disparity between teams that can still afford to push on with some development alongside a really hectic run of races. I guess it could change the competitive picture quite a significant way.
The other thing on this, Mark, is obviously just because you don't have new bits on the car doesn't necessarily mean you can't make gains. We have seen times where teams have actually gained more from just sticking with what they've got and understanding it better. So do you think, firstly, that there could be a little bit of an upside for a team like Haas or some of the other teams that aren't going to be throwing new bits in the car, and at least that they're on firm ground with their understanding, and that they might get, even though the potential of the car isn't increased by putting on new bits, their ability to extract the potential they do have grows because of that stability?
Yeah, we've seen that before, particularly with Haas, actually. And we saw, how they had a better run with the old spec car last year than the new spec one. There's that aspect, which we do quite often see, a better understanding of a existing car. And there's also the fact that even though you're not producing the parts because you can't afford to do it, you can still be developing the car in the virtual world. And so it can be that, we saw a couple of years ago with Force India when it was in financial straits, it was continued to develop the car even though the new bits weren't going on it. And then when it got the new ownership mid-season and the new parts were able to be made, they were sort of three or four steps evolved from what had been on the car at that point. They went straight from spec one to spec four, as it were, because you can continue this development program on CFD and in the tunnel.
Yeah, and obviously in the case of a team like Haas, because they've dialed back the upgrades, they won't have a big step. But yeah, that there is a lot to be gained from having your understanding of the car grow. So let's hope that works for some of those teams. And also, Scott, we have heard that that Mercedes have confirmed that they've got some parts to throw at the car. James Allison, as he always is eloquent in explaining why they've got so many bits in the pipeline.
Yeah, he basically said that because the car that they would have started the season with in Australia and the car that they ran at testing was basically the launch car, a spec that had been frozen, he said, around Christmas time. So January, February and the start of March was all a lot of development work back at base, trying to work out exactly where to improve the car. And then I guess the idea would have been to put those parts into production and then introduce them early in the season. But that hasn't happened, obviously. Now, because the teams have been in either on lockdown in their respective countries or adhering to F1 shutdown regulations, basically simultaneously, but there are still some restrictions in terms of who can go back to work and what the teams can do at the factories, there have been limitations. It's not like they've spent those 3 months manufacturing the parts back at base. So now, or rather since Mercedes was back at work at the start of June, 4 weeks basically to get everything ready for Austria, they're basically working out, right, they've had basically a quarter of a year of development. Now, how do we make sure that translates into physical components that we can take to the track and we know that they'll actually work? So they're basically going to do as much as possible to bring as many of those updates, or as potent a combination of updates as they can for when the season starts in Austria. And then depending on the schedule, depending on how long the season goes on for and what the capacity is back at factory and for the race team, because obviously if you're producing loads of spares, you can't really, it's going to impact your ability to produce upgraded components. So depending on how the season plays out, they will then obviously try to continue development and bring more parts.
Well, speaking of Mercedes, Mark, they've announced that Andy Cowell is leaving his role as managing director of Mercedes High Performance Powertrains at the start of July. He's had a huge impact on the dominance of Mercedes in the 1.6 litre turbo hybrid era. How big a blow do you think this is?
Our long term, it's a great blow. He's one of the, we talk about Adrian Newey as being one of the shining tech director, designer, aerodynamicist, what have you. Andy's the equivalent of that in engine design. This is a guy that did the Cosworth CR1 in 99, which set new standards of technology. Is the guy that did that fantastic BMW engine, which for a time had like a 50 horsepower advantage on the rest of the field. And he subsequently Wilmore, and which subsequently became Mercedes HPP, and that's he's been the boss there since 2012, and was him and Ross Brawn working together several years in advance on the hybrid project was really the foundation of the Mercedes era of dominance that we've had in since 2014. He's not only a brilliant engineer, but he's a brilliant leader of men. And so that whole Brixworth factory, but also the way that the Brixworth factory integrates with the Brackley factory, where the cars on it, it's absolutely singing off. They're all singing off the same hymn sheet, and that's very much down to Andy and the way he visualizes what the task is. It's to do with the lap time of the car. Although he's an engine guy, he absolutely gets where the compromises need to be made. He's not someone that the aerodynamicists are constantly having to fight with, because you know he wants to do something which is going to give more horsepower, or they want to do something which is going to give them better aero. That's never there's never been a struggle there, or it's always just been done on logic and numbers, and that's very much part of his philosophy, and it's ingrained in the culture of those places. So yeah, a massive part of the success that they've had. I would think it's not going to just suddenly switch off all those benefits that he's brought. He'll carry a momentum for a long time yet, but a lot will be hanging on the performance in terms of the long term prospects of the team, the performance that his successors bring, and how much of that they have taken on themselves, and how well they can replicate it.
It's a good time for this transition in many ways, because the you could argue that the hardest part of this engine era has been done, and Andy oversaw that and was the big part of why Mercedes did such a good job of it. The upgrades are now going to be limited over this season, next couple of seasons, and then frozen out completely for a couple of years, which means a decent lead up to the next set of engine regulations, which won't be before 2026. So in that regard, it's a good time for the transition. I guess the stresses and focal points are going to be different, but that doesn't mean that there aren't challenges within that, because with a freeze of specification and limited upgrades means fewer opportunities to address things that you get wrong. And we have seen over the last 18 months or so small reliability gremlins on the Mercedes side, and they were talking at the start of this year about needing to make sure that the engine was a more reliable package for the start of the season, and they have been, legally or otherwise, overtaken or caught by Ferrari and Honda. So Mercedes isn't exactly the clear benchmark in the engine war from a Formula One point of view. So there are pluses and minuses for that. I would like to think that given how higher quality of engineer Andy was, but also a man manager, that not only did he have fantastic lessons for all those other people to learn, but they'd have been encouraged to actually take it on board, because it's not just someone leading by example, it's someone who cares about that succession and making sure that people actually learn from it and realize how to get more out of themselves and out of each other. So I think they'll handle it quite well. I think it's a different kind of challenge to the other big names we've seen depart Mercedes. So you're Nico Rosberg on the driver's side, or Paddy Lowe from a technical chief side, Aldo Costa from that engineering group idea. It's the other part of the business. It's someone who has been much more ingrained in that process, much more of a figurehead as well. So very different challenge, arguably the toughest one so far. But Mercedes has maintained its position on top because it's so good at adjusting to this. And given Cowell is appears to be as much of a top bloke as he is a top engineer, I would imagine that by staying on and assisting with the transition, he will give everything to make sure he leaves Mercedes high performance powertrains in a strong position.
Yeah, this will have been very well prepared for and planned for. And that's one of the great strengths of Brixworth, how far ahead they work. Of course, the first single-cylinder test for the new generation Formula One engines, as the 2014 engines were at the time, was way back in 2010, before the rules were even finalised. So they were well advanced with that project. And that's the reason why they started so well. In fact, I remember seeing the four-cylinder engine block that was obviously the abandoned rule set. It was originally going to be a four-cylinder engine rather than a V6. So they've always been very, very good at looking long-term. And of course, the next challenge on the horizon will be the new engine regulations, currently probably for 2026, but still, that's one of the F1's next big challenges to work on. So that'll be kind of the test, I think, for Brixworth about their succession planning. And I suspect they'll have done it quite well. Fantastic as Andy Cowell is, you know, it's the impact he had on the whole wider organisation around him that was the real testament to that, and I'm sure that will translate into what he leaves behind as well. Now, shall we take a bit of a risk and let you take control, Scott, and move on to Scott's people? I would like an explanation first for what's on your T-shirt. I've been trying to work out what is it, a horse? Is it a dog? Is it a polar bear? Is it an unusually shaped mountain?
It's a Dahl and a Hest. It's a Dahl and a horse. It's basically like the symbol of Dahl and Ar, which is a county north from Stockholm, which is where my partner's parents have a little summer house this T-shirt has a pink Dahl and a Hest on it, and then it has Lexand underneath, and Lexand is like the small town that I bought the T-shirt from, which is where the summer house is. So I like it. I think it's like I said, it's midsummer out here. So I thought I'd and my Swedish football shirt's in the wash. So I thought I'd wear this as a bit of a show of Swedish pride. Why did you ask that? Why ask that question?
I've just been wondering because while you were talking, rather than listening to you, I was just sort of looking around, and I thought, well, I wonder what's going on there. Plus, I think it's quite good because you do a good service to Swedish outreach on this podcast. So it's another chance for you to earn your kickback from the Stockholm Tourism Board.
Yeah, that's fair. I would urge if it were possible to do it safely, I would urge people to check out Sweden in the summer. It's very lovely. And that should actually give me another sort of £200 or £300. So thanks very much, Ed.
Excellent.
Massively appreciated.
Would you like to get on with whatever madness you've got planned for Scott's people?
Yeah, it's not madness, actually. I did ask a question at the end of the last podcast, which was sort of like a no holds barred, where would you like to see F1 go? Because obviously F1 on the in putting together their revised 2020 schedule, they've sort of got a bit more creative. We've got some circuits in the mix that wouldn't have otherwise been in the mix. And we sort of talked a little bit about that on the last podcast, and I wanted to go a little bit mad for this one, but I've changed it. We will do that one probably for the next one, but I changed it because obviously reverse grid races has been a big talking point over the last week or two, and it seems that they're going to be inevitable for 2021, because while they've been able to be blocked by Mercedes for this year, the way that the F1's voting system and governance is going to change for next year, F1 seems quite confident they'll actually be able to table a new vote and get it all pushed through. And I put a little poll out on Twitter. I got nearly 1,000 responses, which I was really, really pleased with. And it wasn't so much the breakdown of responses that I cared about. It was more the really sort of sensible explanations that people gave. A lot of people didn't want to just vote in the poll. They messaged me to give me their feedback, so I wanted to sort of rattle through a few of the, and some of them are reasoned and some of them are the obligatory hatred and short and to the point social media messages that such a topic draws. So one of the common responses, so Jerome at Jimmy Manor said he's against it. Of course, qualifying should be forever about the ultimate lap time. It should never be about racing. Another response was for, I've got no idea how to pronounce this because it's just a Twitter account name. Ophitus21, Ophitus20, I don't know. Anyway, they said that they're fully against it because it's gimmicky and trying to fix non-existent issues. I'm not entirely convinced by that. But the problem with F1, they say, is solved by creating a better technical regulation and the cost cap. These are ready to be introduced in 2022. NASCAR has tried for years gimmicks with the format and look at the results. I fully get it, and I still hate it because it will disrupt the season unfairly. Three races in a shorter season can have a monumental impact on the championship to the point a different champion could be crowned. I don't think that's a particularly unfair position to take. But Mark, do you think that if that happened, if say, for example, we had three really random results in the races that say would have been affected by a reverse grid qualifying race, do you think that would have put an asterisk against the season in any way?
No, everybody starts with the same chance, don't they? And you've just got to go with what you're given, the hand you're dealt with, haven't you? So no, I don't think there's any aspect against anything that gets achieved by anyone this year. It's the season that they're being asked to compete in, and everybody's under the, you know, got the same circumstances. So no, I disagree with that.
That's fair. Richard Towler said F1 has always been about ultimate driver versus machine and the best of the best. You earn it, have to work hard for it. Qualifying is that ultimate one lap, fastest car, fastest driver gets it, and it's amazing to watch. There are so many races we consider classics because they sprung up surprises. If we make that whatever the new norm is, we lose that. I want to solve the real problems with the cars, but also for the sport to stand for something. It's been directionless for too long. I want to watch the best race and fastest person win, but I also want to remember the special races. We're obsessed with everything becoming special all the time, but if it becomes the norm and the norm isn't special, we get used to whatever that is. What do you reckon, Ed?
There'll always be a spread of quality of races. I've got no problem with overall increasing the quality of everything. I would argue that because the number of absolutely classic races isn't quite as many as we'd like. I'd agree. You want races to be special. You don't want overtaking to be too cheap or race wins to be too cheap. But I see where he's coming from. But there's often suggestions for lots of little things that can be done to guarantee excitement, to contrive things, etc. One of the reasons why the reverse grid thing is something I'm willing to consider is it's a single thing you can do that will have a huge impact on a number of different areas. So I actually think it's less interventionalist than a number of other measures that have been suggested. It modifies and redefines what it means to win a Grand Prix. It means that by definition, if you win a race, you will have had to have raced well. I don't think automatically having any kind of reverse grids will mean every race is Suzuka 2005. I just think it increases the possibility. But the fundamental thing is, I listen to the complaints that are regularly levelled about Formula One over a very long time now. And they are almost always fundamentally down to the fact that if you arrange the cars in order of fastest first down to slowest, why do we expect there to be great racing? Because racing is built on variables of pace, etc., and people being out of position. So that's the kind of philosophical quandary at the heart of it. My only real stipulation is I think anything we do has to be equitable, which is why I dislike randomized grids. It's foolish to aim to make every race automatically a thrill a minute by mandating all these thrills, but I do think if you can create more interesting conditions, you'll have downstream effects. For example, you will have to make your aero map a little bit more benign because you're going to have to follow people more often. You can't just qualify at the front and pull away. Little things like that could have a surprisingly large impact.
Oh, Ed. Oh, sorry, you froze. I thought we'd lost you. Anyway, sorry. I think that it looks like Skype couldn't quite handle the ferocity of that monologue in response to reverse grid, so it froze on my end.
I think Skype was right to stop me at that point.
To cut you off. That was the virtual hook, wasn't it, from the side of the stage? They played the music.
It's normally what I have to do to you.
Yeah, well, in fairness, I'm not the worst offender of that on the podcast. I'll rattle off a few of the guys who were a bit more sort of on your side on this debate, Ed. So Anil Palmer said that he's supportive, but willing to accept it might not work, which I think is an important position for F1 to take. You can try it, but you have to be willing to accept if it doesn't work. But that's part of the beauty of it. You then actually have it as a proper case study rather than just hypotheticals. Adri Garcia said, can't be more boring than the last seven seasons. It's too easy for top teams to qualify at the front. Back in the 2000s, they had one lap only. So that seems to be a slightly different argument, to be honest, sort of an advocation of a return to one lap qualifying and just sort of heighten the challenge. Adam Smith said, it's worth a try just to see what happens. It can't be worse than seeing another pole to win and the rest of the grid finishes next to their teammate, maximum plus or minus one from their starting position. I understand that. That's quite a common position, I think, for some fans who are against who are in favour of reverse grids to take, because there just seems to be this perception that all F1 races now are boring, which just isn't true. As you said, Ed, there's a spread of quality among them. And then just a few more. So Stuart Coulter said, presented a rather mad alternative, which would be to have normal qualifying on Saturday morning, followed by the race on Saturday afternoon for constructors' points only. Then the result of that race is reversed to set the grid for the Grand Prix, which is drivers' points only. I'm glad that Stuart admitted that that was a mad format, because that is he's gone off piste there. He's moved so far away from the original question. And then let's finish off with a couple more. At Griffin Beach said, I'm for it during these double headers for this very odd season, just to mix things up, but not for when things get back to normal. I can see that's kind of F1's logic, isn't it? Is that we've got exceptional circumstances at the moment, so it's worth having a go. My only problem with that is if you do it for the first few races and don't do it for others, it can get to the point where you're artificially mixing the results slightly too much. Adam Barton says, I'm for it as a test, but I wouldn't want it as a championship race. Also conscious of what it does to stats. What do you think, Mark? Obviously, Formula One's not really in a position to have non-championship races, but the stats element's quite a curious one, because obviously, I guess it would... first of all, it would render sort of pole positions, I guess, obsolete for reverse grid races, but podiums and points finishes and stuff like that would be impacted. Does that matter from a historical perspective?
I think it's already been polluted, hasn't it? I mean, as soon as you change the point system, you can't really compare points. As soon as you introduce refueling or tyre stops, you get anomalous fastest laps because somebody pits near the end for fresh tyres when they've got virtually no fuel in, and so you can have a very mediocre car set the fastest lap. So a lot of those things have gone anywhere. It's more of a bookkeeper's fetish that seems to be attracted to those things. I don't think in the wider picture it matters so much. It's interesting. We're all interested in looking at the stats. We're interested in looking at who's got the greatest average of wins per starts and things like that, because it probably tells us something. I don't think we need to get bogged down in it. I don't think the stats should be steering the direction of the sport.
Speaking of someone who I do love stats, because they can tell you things, but they're not in themselves a thing, should we say. They're a means to an end. They're not an end in themselves. Racing does not exist to generate statistics. That's not its end point. You can point to any number of things that have happened over the years that distort the statistics. One of the early World Championship races was Indy 500. The number of times I've done statistical analysis pieces and I've had to discount the anomalous Indy 500s of 1950 to 1960. You know, right from the start, they were polluted. Is Johnny Parsons an F1 race winner? Of course he isn't. But some statistics say he is. These things are there to learn something from, but you can't be absolutist. The list of wins in order is not a list of the worthiness of all drivers in order. There are drivers who've won Grand Prix who are worse than those who never won Grand Prix but should have done. So I don't think you want to be too driven by the statistics.
I'll end with two very quick ones. Ross H said he loves the fact that there are so different options. Two totally different spectacles to make up a great weekend. Qualifying, drivers on the limit over a single lap with the one putting it together, taking it pole, and the race, honouring racecraft, overtaking strategy, tyre management. He thinks that both qualifying and the race are integral parts of Formula One, so obviously very much in favour of keeping it as is. And the final one, Chris Hilton, they can do a reverse grid race, but use it to award half points. Don't use it to determine the grid for the main race. Keep traditional qualifying for that. I think in itself, I understand why that's being pitched, but that isn't what F1's worried about here. It's not about adding something new. It's not about adding a second race to the schedule because they want a second race. It's trying to mix it up so that the whole weekend sort of takes a slightly different form. And then it's one thing leads to another and it's all part of the same narrative rather than just a reverse grid race for the sake of having a reverse grid race within the format. So I like the idea, but it isn't part of this.
If people complaining about the reverse grids even been considered, are the same people who might complain if the second Red Bull race is identical to the first. I suspect there will be differences which would be interesting, but we've got a kind of test in that we've got these two double headers at least. We will probably have another double header or two down the line as well. So we're kind of testing of what happens if you don't have them, which will also be interesting. But this is the reason, you know, I don't mind keeping traditional qualifying, starting race order, etc. But the reason, to reiterate why I'm open to it, is because there's been such a volume of people telling me how dull it all is and predictable it all is over a very long period of time. So that's why it has to be considered.
Yep, no, I agree. So there's loads of responses that I've got that we just don't have time to go through. So if you wanted to have your comment read out, but you were forced to sit through Ed ranting twice, send him a message at EdStrawF1 on Twitter. Make sure that you spam him with all of your hatred for blocking your airtime. But we will be back with Scott's people in the future, and we will go with the original plan for this week. So the question will be, if you had an unlimited choice of a place to have an F1 race, what would it be and why? So I will ask that on Twitter as well with the hashtag Scott's people.
Splendid. Look forward to getting some complaints and some interesting ideas. Well, thanks very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes, and to everyone for listening. Do head to the races website, that's therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen, loads to read on there. Check out our YouTube channel as well and our other podcasts, including the Gary Anderson F1 show. Next Monday, we'll be back with our second attempt at a 2020 Formula One season preview.